Welcome to Stories, a thread within the Protein podcast that features the stories behind the people at the intersection of community, culture, and technology. I'm not going to lie, Lucy's pretty badass. She ditched her career in the music industry to help fund and win legal cases against Shell and other baddies. And more recently, launched Climate Spring, which is shifting the narrative on climate change by commissioning screenwriters and filmmakers to create believable near-future fiction. This was recorded in front of a live audience in our studio in Tisbury. Enjoy. Welcome, Lucy. Excited to have you on the podcast. And I've been thinking about this conversation for a while, I have to say, because I was like, I could cover so many different things. So hopefully we will cover most of them. But let's start at the beginning in terms of what you're, I guess, best known for at the moment.
At the moment. Well, at the moment I run an organization called Climate Spring, which works to try to change the narrative on climate change. And we do that by working with creatives in the film and TV industry. And that is about providing support to tell better stories about the moment that we're in at the moment.
And what was the sort of the conception of that idea? Like, what was the, was there an event? Was there a aha moment? Where did it all begin?
Well, it was brewing for a really long time, actually. So I've worked in climate change for a long time, a couple of decades, I guess. And I've always worked, I was drawn to work on climate change, not because I wanted to save the polar bears, but because I was drawn to climate change as the kind of ultimate human people crisis, what it meant for us as a people. That's always what interested me about climate change. And I always saw it as a communications problem, actually. So when I was studying climate change at university, I was sitting at the back of the lecture hall thinking, Christ, this is really important, but man, this is really boring. And they are really not communicating this in any way that is going to engage anyone. And if I'm sitting here and I've chosen to study this, we've got no hope of engaging anyone outside the lecture hall. So I've been thinking about this my whole career. How do we do this? How do we explain what is a very complicated, very frankly overwhelming, scary subject for most people? How do we engage people in a way that doesn't engender fear, paralysis, or I don't want to know about it because it's too much? So I've been thinking about this a lot, and I've tried lots of different tactics. I've worked on campaigns, I've worked on, you know, public engagement strategies, politics, you know, heck, worked on, you know, suing people on climate grounds, because that's a good strategy.
We're coming to
that.
Which
we can talk about in a minute. And the thread has always been, what are the stories we're telling about this issue, and how, you know, what does it mean to people to talk about climate? And so this idea is brewing for a really long time, which was in a way quite a simple idea, which is scientists and climate activists, I love them and they're brilliant people, but they're not the best communicators. They're not the best people to explain this in a way that gets you here in your gut and not in your head. So I was mulling the idea of what would good storytelling look like for a long time. And in fact, an old university friend reminded me that when I was back studying at university climate change, I immediately went and did a film course straight away afterwards, because I thought, well, maybe that's the way we tell better stories. So it's kind of it's taken me to here to kind of figure out what is it that we need, and what are the storytellers need to help tell the story in a way that's going to really capture the public imagination. So that was the kind of that's the long route to how I got to here, and set it up with three people from the film and TV industry.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And practically speaking, where does sort of Climate Spring fit within the film commissioning, production, distribution world?
So we're not a production company ourselves. We don't Crate Productions. We're a funder, so we provide investment in mostly into production companies or into or to creatives directly. We provide investment to support the development. So the early stage, when you've got a kernel of an idea or a book you want to adapt, and we provide funding, support, and then a lot of experts, both climate expert support and then industry expertise in getting that kind of an idea developed, written, produced and made. So we're kind of behind the scenes supporting the creatives and the producers who actually go do the making.
Yeah, amazing. And who are you looking for? Like, what's your invitation out there for creatives or screenwriters at the moment?
Well, it's quite interesting because when we started Climate Spring, it was about 3 years ago. It was a really nascent conversation in the industry. So there were a few people in the industry who were kind of becoming climate activists and feeling, you know, we need to do something about this issue. But there wasn't really a sense of how, as a writer or a director or as a creative, how can you engage in your practice, in your work? And now there is, I mean, a huge appetite, but it's, you know, the challenge is how do you do that in a very challenging, commercially challenging environment where, you know, attention span is, you know, being fought over and there's a lot of content being made, you know, there's a proliferation of channels and, you know, you're fighting for people's attention. And it's a challenging environment to create content that cuts through and is a success. It's a, you know, science and an art, and there's no real answer. So, but in that context, there's a real appetite. I mean, same in literature. We've seen in the publishing world a huge growth in climate fiction and writers engaging and grappling with this topic. And I think, in fact, you could look at every sector and everybody is grappling with, what does this mean for me? What does it mean for my industry? And in that context, it's a question of, you know, engaging with that and trying to help answer those questions.
Yeah. And I saw that you've launched a new fund. Is this the one that's happening at Hay? Is that correct?
We've launched the first climate fiction prize, literary prize, yes, nice. Which is really exciting. So we've sort of supported it at Climate Spring. There's a team who have a background in running fiction prizes from the publishing industry, and Tisbury's very own Helen, who's in the audience, who's working, supporting the book prize. So yeah, we're really excited about this, and we're publicly launching it at Hay Festival with a judging panel from the literary world. And yeah, it's exciting because it gives a kind of, hopefully it elevates climate fiction and, you know, helps sell more books and, you know, get more people reading about climate fiction and provides an incentive to the publishing world, you know, to support climate fiction. So yeah, that's exciting.
Right. And why fiction rather than non-fiction?
Well, because stories that are fiction, I mean, there's a whole science on it, actually. Fiction does something to people in a way that facts don't, right? So it's actually what our brains are hardwired to be tuned into. So we've always told stories. It's how we've communicated. It's the sort of social fabric, you know. And there is a really interesting science that when you hear a story or when you watch a story, how you biologically, physically respond to that is very different to if you're listening to facts. So if you're listening to a documentary with facts, you respond to it differently. It releases on endorphins. It puts you in a relaxed kind of mode that lets you suspend belief. And you can put yourself in somebody else's shoes. You can imagine yourself in another place, in another time. So it's a very powerful tool for getting people to get out of their heads and way of thinking and see things differently, right? But it's also that the stories we tell say something about who we think we are, right? So the stories we tell collectively and that you know, how those add up together, so it speak to what we value, you know, how we see ourselves in relationship to each other, what we think is important, what we think is aspirational, you know, that is carried through our stories. So they, in fact, I would say that's the biggest block now with the climate crisis. You know, we have a bit of an imagination block now. We cannot imagine that we can do this, that we can live in a really different way. It's, and there's a reason for that, which we could talk about. There's a kind of narrative capture that's happened through culture, which has made us not believe that there's a different way of being. So if you can unlock that sense of belief, I think you can unlock a sense of agency. And that's, I think, where we are in the climate crisis. We don't need to tell people it's a fact anymore, that everyone gets that. They can feel it. They can experience it. We need people to understand that it's possible, that we can do this. It's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy. But it might actually be a good thing. we might all be better off for it.
Yeah, let's hope so. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's sort of imagining a better future, right? And creating those futures that we all want to be part of. Yeah. On a very practical, relatable level, I mean, what are the examples out there that you sort of aspire to create in terms of films or shows that have that are currently out there that people might already seen or know about?
There's really few examples of good climate stories. It's kind of why we're here, but they're not out in the world yet. But I think the kind of thing we're talking about is, I mean, if you think one of the cinematic superpowers, right, is a kind of world-building superpower. If you think about kind of the optimism of 60s sci-fi, you know, that imagines the future, hoverboards and, you know, amazing cityscapes, that kind of incredible cinematic language of what the future could look like. I feel like, where is that right now? Why are we missing that? Perhaps why we're missing that is because that's where we are culturally. We're all a bit stuck. We're kind of stuck in this flight or fight mode where everything's quite scary and overwhelming. So you can go back and you can kind of go back to history and imagine things then, or you can go to dystopia, and we see a lot of that, right, in our culture. But, you know, that kind of, yeah, that cinematic world building of having fun with playing with what would it look like if we were regenerative? What would the world look like if we weren't run on fossil fuels and we valued nature in the same way that we value each other? You know, that is a kind of, not just for film and TV, but for the creative world, that is a kind of, there's a real power, I think. And then the other sort of types of stories that I think are great, kind of metaphor stories about people going on a journey, you know, and there's lots of examples of that. So, you know, people have had to overcome great adversity, whether it's tackling big social justice issues and inequality. And there are so many good examples, right, of people coming together and journeying literally or metaphorically. And I think those are kind of the stories we need.
After the Flood on ITV?
Oh, yes. Is one of the projects we supported. Yeah, yes.
Great.
So we didn't fund it. It was already had been commissioned by ITV, but they asked our help because, so this is it was a six part, I think, sort of prime time murder mystery thriller, ITV. And the writer, the screenwriter and the production company and the commissioner all wanted it to be a climate story in the sense that it was set in a Yorkshire village that was being flooded because of climate. In the flood, a dead body is washed up, and it's a basic, you know, murder mystery. Who's the dead body and what happened to him? And it's a police drama, and there's a policewoman who's the central character. She's a great character. But in the backdrop of the story, the village is grappling with climate impacts. They're also trying to figure out who's responsible for that. There's a bit of kind of accountability and activism, and the community trying to kind of come together to deal with and prevent the impacts of climate change. And what was really interesting about it is it's, you know, it's not marketed as a climate story because no one will watch it. If you to say everyone, to, you know, if you market
especially,
it as a climate story, it's a murder mystery, you know, in a Yorkshire village. Great, I want to watch that. And I work on climate change and I want to watch that, not a climate story. And it was really thoughtfully done. I think the screenwriter approached it really well. So we worked with the screenwriter and the production company to think about how he's putting it in his script. So literally in the dialogue, but also in the backdrop of the story. So we, you know, introduced them to flood experts. We took them to a village in Yorkshire and they met some, you know, local experts working on climate projects. And it was interesting because the reviews for that also highlighted the good climate storytelling element, which was great because yeah, it shows you don't have to kind of sacrifice the entertainment for the climate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's good.
I mean, that's what I was going to get to in terms of the response for it. And then ultimately, if the climate narrative is not the main, you know, component, you know, how you measure that, right? And how you know that it's working.
Yeah.
Is that included? Or, I mean, I know that's a very tangential, subjective piece, but is that included in as part of the process?
You mean an understanding of what impact would look like? Well, you know, for TV and film, impact is, you know, number of people watching it. You know, it's, does it do well commercially? Does it make a profit, essentially? You know, what's its reach? You know, is it bringing in new audiences? That's okay for me, because that's the same way we measure our impact. Is it reaching people that wouldn't otherwise watch a David Attenborough documentary about climate change, you know? In a way, what's the story we're trying to tell? The story we're trying to tell is not actually about telling people about climate. We're not trying to communicate the science of climate change and that it's a thing and it's happening. You know, climate change is the symptom of the problem, right? It's in fact one symptom, one of many symptoms. And so the real story that we need to tell is, you know, why are we here? Why are we in this mess? Who got us here? It's actually... it's not most people's fault, the reason why we're in the mess we're in. It's been a deliberate strategy to lock society into fossil fuels. How do we get out of here? So that's the kind of journey story. What's the route out of this? And then where do we land and what does that look like? So the story doesn't have to be always talking about climate. So that's kind of, that's how we think about what a successful kind of a good climate story looks like. And then impact, yeah, is a mix. And I think for the production company and for the commissioner, unusually they were interested in that as much as, obviously, they want people to watch the show and it's got to be a commercial success. It's a, you know, an industry. But they wanted to see how, if they could tell a climate story in that more subtle way without, you know, being too preachy, and ultimately, you know, it's an entertaining story. Yeah. So, yeah.
But you are set up and it is measured in a commercial context in terms of how you fund and what the returns are. So on that level, that still follows a traditional, you know, film commissioning sort of process.
Yes, because, you know, so we are not a kind of grant making organization. So we don't write checks for grants for projects. We invest in projects. And so that's a kind of test. Like, if it's going to, is it going to make a return? You can never guarantee. It's a risk always. But it's a good measure of, it's a good test to see if it's going to have an impact and how much of a success. And you have to use the industry's own measures of success, because that's the aim, is to support the industry in what it's trying to do, which is its core business. It's not going to work if we make some really beautiful content that no one watches, or, you know, climate activists watch, as much as I love them. That's not really the plan. So,
And what... And zooming out a bit, what does that look like at the moment in terms of the commissioning landscape? Where, which channels are most receptive to these sorts of programs? I mean, what are you seeing out there at the moment?
So, do you remember when Glasgow COP happened, the climate conference happened in Glasgow a few years back? So all the British commissioners and some streamers made a kind of a pledge to commission more climate content. They all sort of signed up to say, we're going to commission more climate content. So it was a good few years ago now.
Was this a Climate Spring initiative?
Or? No, it was not us, actually. It was an industry initiative. And so this was, you know, Channel 4, ITV, BBC. They all said, we want to commission more climate content. And we talk to commissioners all the time, obviously, because we're trying to understand what they're looking for, and we try and help provide that. There is a commissioner commitment, but it's obviously nuanced, because also, you know, because a kind of hard-nosed business decision about what they're going to commission. So I think there's a commissioner desire, but it's rarely on-the-nose climate commissioning. You know, it will always be, does it have climate in the story? And then the question is it kind of tokenistic? And in a way, it's quite like the diversity and equality, the Me Too movement, right? Think about gender in the industry. You know, there's always a risk it becomes tokenistic. do you have a black character on screen? You know, that is not necessarily the way to do diversity. There's a risk with climate. It becomes someone's mentioned climate, tick, I've done my commissioner objective. And I don't think any commissioner really wants to do that. But, you know, a pledge can get you so far, but it illustrates an industry appetite. And we know lots of screenwriters really want to tell, frankly, it's the story of our time, isn't it? You know, everybody wants to be telling that story. It's this challenge of how to do it. So I think that's the space we're in, which is a good place to be. It's not, we're pushing on an open door, and then it's just a question of navigating in a difficult landscape for the industry at the moment.
And technology as an important part of that, you know, distribution, but also more recently with AI or OpenAI's, I don't know if you saw it today, Sora, which is the filmmaking engine from OpenAI, produced its first sort of short film, which was, I mean, it's not going to win many awards, but in terms of, I guess, sort of the role in technology, and I guess specifically AI in the creative process as part of, you know, the narrative storytelling. And I mean, I have a lot of personal opinions on this, but I would love to hear yours in terms of what AI might be better used for rather than taking away all of the creative skills out there. But yeah, I don't know if you got any thoughts on that.
I don't know, actually. So I have lots of thoughts too, but I think I'm still forming them. I mean, I think there's quite a terrifying energy impact of AI. I don't know if you've heard this. The energy demand from AI is going to blow everything out of the water, basically. So, and that, it's not minor. So at the moment, you know, we're actually in the middle of a massive transition at the moment. That's the story that's not really talked about. Well, we're in a transition in the sense that, what was it?
The gods agreed with you. They thundered.
Oh, right. Yeah. The thunder.
Hopefully we'll get that on the mic. Yeah.
So it's not just that there's climate impacts are happening, you know, and things are getting harder and the weather's changing. Of course, that's all happening. And it's, you know, that's already happening. Whatever we do, that is now happening and will continue to get worse. Unfortunately, now we're locked into that now because we've kind of left it quite late. But the other big transition that we're in the middle of, which is sort of the other, in a way, the other climate story that's not really talked about, which is our energy system is going through an enormous transition at the moment. You know, the fossil fuel industry is fighting tooth and nail to keep us locked into oil and coal. But renewable energy is now cheaper. So kind of basic economics are changing the energy generation. But we're not producing enough energy to meet the growing demand for energy, you know, and we are becoming a more and more energy consuming society. And that's before you factor in the really rapidly growing economies. So that was already happening. So the amount of renewables we have to build is astronomical, not just to replace the fossil fuel that is causing climate, but also to meet the growing demand. And then you bring in AI and it kind of blows everything out of the water. So it slightly terrifies me just from that one dimension of AI before you even get into the kind of what it means for creatives and what it means for IP. And that feel, I mean, obviously that was the one of the things that writers were striking about. You know, this is a live debate. And I think it's the Pandora's box is open, right? And it's kind of racing ahead without anyone really steering it. And that is, it does sort of personally slightly terrify me. But I think from Climate Spring's perspective, we're just focused really on supporting the creatives. And that's a slightly lame get out of the question, isn't it? But I don't know. Yeah, that's my honest kind of feeling. It terrifies me. Just on the energy dimension before you even get into anything else. But yes, it feels, I don't know, what do you think? Well,
I mean, 100%. And if you take the position of what is involved or what is the impact, what is the number of gigawatts that it costs to run the NVIDIA servers that are creating all of the responses to the queries? Mm. Like that is a fundamental contradiction to what it is
that
you're asking it to query.
it's like
help save, you know, the climate. It's like, well, let's not use these big machines. And I think the caveat to it is if there are efficiencies or it can be trained in a way that it can actually create more of a like a net positive from problem solving or an efficiency of a system or a, like the super complex stuff. But a lot of friends in the creative industry, they're like, I mean, they are terrified. The designers, the creators, the writers. I mean, look at Francesca.
Yeah, it is. It's really scary.
But it's, and that to me is sort of, it's sort of been pointed in the wrong direction.
Well, it's not being pointed in any direction in a way. True, maybe that's the problem.
It is. But it's being allowed to sort of facilitate and be developed in this direction because it helps people understand what's possible with it when actually AI's existed for years. It's always been happening behind the scenes and booking systems, all the boring operational stuff, which is actually where personally it's best placed and best suited. But that's a whole nother discussion.
That's a whole nother podcast.
I'd love to go back one step
pre-Climate
Spring to File Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
And appreciate there's some things that you can't talk about, but would love if you could just to talk about some of the things that you got up to there, taking the baddies down.
Sure. So as I said at the beginning, when you've been working on climate change for a long time, it can feel frustrating after a while. And, you know, trying lots of different tactics, pleading governments, you know, to listen to their advisors, campaigning, and lots of scientists now have become so frustrated because they feel they've done their job. They're chaining themselves, you know, to buildings and desperation. There's a high level of anxiety amongst climate scientists. And it's totally understandable, and I feel it. So I was really drawn to litigation as a strategy because, so litigation we often think of as, well, just in the American sense, suing someone for damages, right? But litigation can be in the broader sense using the law, right? So it can be using the law to create accountability, just right a wrong, or prevent something from happening. So File Foundation is a, it's a climate foundation that supports, funds brave, incredible lawyers all around the world bringing legal cases against the perpetrators of the climate crisis, which are not just fossil fuel companies, but are banks, you know, governments, all the institutions that have the power to change the trajectory we're on and are not. And it's a really, I find it a really fascinating strategy. And I was drawn to it because of the story strategy, what it says, you know, a legal strategy can quite clearly tell you who's responsible. It's not you or I, actually, really. It's, you know, the board of this company. They're responsible. They made some specific decisions. It tells you who's impacted. You know, there's a consequence, and then it gives a remedy, a legal remedy, which is what do you need to do to resolve the problem. So kind of a nice framing for what is often really complex, right? And we're often told it's all our fault, and you know, I don't want to say that we shouldn't all do something about it. Heck, we should all be doing the very most we can. We're at a point of crisis, but you know, we're in this mess because certain individuals and organizations made decisions to keep us locked into a certain trajectory. And so it's a quite a powerful tool. So File, it's a kind of behind, a bit like Climate Spring, it's kind of behind the scenes, providing a lot of the support. And I focused on how we are communicating all of this. So working with journalists and documentary filmmakers and researchers. And I loved it. It was really fascinating. And there are, I think, something like 3,000 climate cases going through the courts at the moment, and they're amazing.
And some of the bigger ones that people might have heard of,
you might have heard of the Shell case that was brought against Shell, the oil company, the energy company, when it was headquartered in the Netherlands. This was a case brought against Shell, and the case was basically trying to create legal accountability for Shell's responsibility for its emissions. And the campaigners won the case, and what was most interesting about the case, it might sound really obvious that they're responsible for climate carbon emissions, of course they are, but the ruling said no, Shell are also responsible for the emissions produced when you fill up your car in the petrol station. So if you go and fill up your car, they're responsible for those emissions. And, you know, that has been the strategy of the industry for a long time, to put the responsibility on all of us. You know, BP invented the carbon calculator to make us all feel we need to be responsible for our carbon emissions, not BP. It's what the plastics industry did with recycling. You all need to do the recycling rather than us not preventing the problem in the first place. It's a clever strategy and we've all kind of fallen for it. So the ruling was very clear. The judge said, yes, you're responsible for that, Shell, and you need to cut it in half by in 8 years' time. And this ruling was about 3 years ago now. So they had 8 years to cut their emissions in half, which is huge. I mean, that was to be compliant with the Paris Climate Agreement. That was a big ask. So what did they do? What could they have done as an energy company? They could have gone to their board and said, well, we've lost the court ruling and we now are being ordered by the court to reduce our emissions. We're going to have to change our strategy. We're going to have to double down in renewables. But of course they didn't. They decided to fight the court case and appeal it. And, you know, that says everything about how disingenuous they are and how much of a foe they are. They're not our friend. So that's one example. And then there's a case going through the European courts at the moment by some youth climate activists. And this is a court case trying to compel European governments to do more about climate change under European court law. There are loads. There was one in Brazil against Bolsonaro trying to prevent Amazon rainforest deforestation. So, there are loads. And I think they're really powerful stories about accountability. And when they win, they can change the law and that can change the rules of the game. So, yes. Yeah,
love it. And continuing on that, I guess, sort of trajectory and bringing that impact sort of here locally, Tisbury.
Yeah.
What brought you home?
To Tisbury.
Yeah.
Well, I was quite happily living in London. But my father was really ill. He lives here, where I grew up, in Tisbury. He was really ill and it was just at a point where I had little children. They were quite young. Oh, and I was working on a big campaign in London about air pollution, and the air pollution impacts on babies was a new discovery I discovered as I was pregnant, walking around London, feeling quite horrified that no one knew about this.
I remember reading that as well.
I'm thinking, Christ, what am I doing to my baby? And it suddenly felt like how we probably feel about seeing pregnant women smoking and in the cinema. I think, how could you have done that? We didn't know. So my father was really ill and I could do it from anywhere. So we decided to come here temporarily. It was supposed to be just for a year, have a bit of fresh air and then get back to London. But obviously kind of fell back in love with living here and living in the countryside and a different way of living, different way of life. And I can't imagine going back to London now. As much as I love London, didn't go back, basically. Stuck around.
And, yeah. I mean, I know Gus is also involved, your husband, but maybe touch on some of the projects that have come out from the NADA Community Energy Group and some of the local initiatives of putting that philosophies and ethos into practice here.
Well, I'm a big believer. I mean, I don't know about you, but I think most people feel, right, that climate change... so scary and overwhelming, and the only things you're offered as an answer to, as an individual, unless you're, you know, on the board of an oil company or you're a politician, you have slightly a different role to play. But if you're just, you know, somebody, it's not their job, you can become a climate activist, you know, and that's quite scary for some people. Don't know if I want to chain myself to something, get arrested, or you can do some little individual things in your lifestyle, right? That's kind of all you're given to do as an individual. And I think that's ridiculous, because I think there's a whole kind of spectrum of things you can do that are far more meaningful than, you know, use a recyclable coffee cup, which frankly is not going to really make any dent in the problem. So I think there's a space of coming together with other people to make change locally is really powerful. In itself, okay, it's always going to be small scale compared to the scale of the problem, but it's bigger than your own little individual action, and it begets bigger change. So the more you do it, the more you work with people to create change, the more you want to do to create more change. And then that can inspire other people, and you can learn from other people. In fact, down the road from here, Chettle is a brilliant village who are doing and loads of incredible community-led initiatives. And you suddenly start finding out about them. You suddenly realise how many projects are happening. So when we moved down here, we got involved in community-owned energy, which I love. It's just a way of building, you know, wind turbines or solar panels without it being privately owned. So you come together, you pool your money together, and it's a cooperative model, essentially. So you can have members in it and everybody can chip in some money, and then you collectively own the energy resource. And as a co-op, you can return a bit of profit to the members, but any surplus profit, you know, you can decide what to do with it, like a charity. So NADA Community Energy has put solar panels on lots of local schools, on the NADA Centre. Wow, it was really some lightning going outside.
And it's all happening tonight.
It's all happening. The energy is here, guys. It's in Tisbury.
Just wait for the power cut. we got candles. We're all right. This runs on batteries.
Great. So it's a kind of alternative model to private ownership and state ownership, right? And so NADA Community Energy... I joined initially on the board. It's, you know, voluntary position. We put solar panels on the roof of schools, and Gustavo, my husband, is now involved, and they helped set up an electric car club. And the idea of that is that you for a lot of people, buying an electric car is not always affordable. So a pooled car club means you can rent it for the day or for an hour. And it's a resource. It's a community resource, like the solar panel.
Yeah, yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Is this like a family thing? You're the sort of climate ambitions, or is it a creative thing?
I'm the lone wolf on that one. In fact, my family are all quite creative. I don't really know where it came from. I think all my family I would probably describe themselves as environmentalists. My father is definitely a real environmentalist. And they're that kind of generation of, you know, 60s hippies who it was part of their identity. So I think they would definitely describe themselves as environmentalists and nature lovers, rather than, you know, climate so much. But yeah, I'm the only one in my family working on climate as a job.
But yeah. Was there a moment that, as a younger Lucy, when did climate enter your sort of consciousness as something that you really want to dedicate your career to?
I kind of vaguely remember learning about school, but not really. I didn't really land to me then. I really actually thought I was going to be a writer. That's what I thought I was going to be when I was growing up. And I was, you know, doing, you know, arts subjects. And so I never thought I could study science. That was kind of way, way beyond my skill set. But when I left school, I found myself in the music industry. That's a whole other story. But I found myself in the music industry, which is another mental industry. And I was music obsessed. I mean, music was my absolute life. Music and books, basically. But music kind of took over my life in my early 20s and at university. And so I messed around in the music industry for a while. And then, you know, increasingly found it quite... It's quite a toxic industry 20 years ago, particularly for a woman, particularly for a young woman. And then the fun started wearing off a little bit. And I just remember, I don't know where it was, but I remember reading about climate change, and it was probably a little article or something. And I remember reading,
How old were you then?
I guess I was 23 or something like that, maybe 22. And I read about it, and it was something, the line was something like, well, they didn't really understand what it was, climate, but just the line was, it's the biggest challenge humanity's ever faced, ever, or probably ever will face. And we've got a window of time in the next 30 years, that was then. And I thought, oh, well, I'm 20. I mean, that's basically my career. That's basically my adult life. I should maybe that's what I should probably do something about, because maybe that's a bit more useful than I'm messing around in the music industry. So basically, I thought, yeah, I think I'll do that with my life, because that sounds quite important. And that is my adult life. You know, I could use my adult career to do something, try and do something about that. But I didn't really know how or what, because I thought, I'm not a scientist. I don't think I can do this climate thing. Yeah. And I think that's a barrier for a lot of people, right? They think they have to be an expert on the science. But yeah. Anyway, yeah.
And it also becomes very overwhelming.
For sure.
With the details of the...
Yeah.
Yeah, the anxiety that comes with something that's completely out of your control.
Yeah.
I'm conscious of time and our very well-behaved audience who listen very quietly. Can't say about the weather, though. If anybody has any burning questions, I would love to hear them.
Thanks so much, first of all, Lucy, for sharing your story. It's like hopeful in itself, because I think we're all looking for ways that we can contribute. I am a writer and a storyteller, and I want to transition into the space of, like, how can I use language as a force for good? Mm-hmm. How can we help people reimagine what living might look like in 10, 20, 30 years' time? Mm. I think what I still feel like I see a lot, and I think because culturally and narratively we're living in this binary, you know, it's like hope or despair.
Right.
So we have stories that are kind of attached to
both
of those. Like, how do we bring those two things together, do you think, in a more meaningful way?
I totally agree, and it's my real bugbear. And I try to be really careful with my language. I don't know if I always succeed, because you're right, it's not a binary. And unfortunately, we're way past the point in which we can have an orderly transition away to be towards something really beautiful and nice, and everything's going to be fine. I'm afraid it's going to be really hard, and it's going to be really messy. Look, we're feeling it already. If you step back, you can see it. We are already in a really tough, difficult place. And that, I'm not just talking about the mad weather that's happening, but, you know, farmers are experiencing it. Their crops are failing. You know, they're not able to grow things in the way they could. You know, we are... we're starting to see the breakdown of a fossil fuel extractive economy. So the big promise of it for a long time, right, was that it improves your lives, right? We're all going to be better off for it. You know, cars are symbols of freedom, right? I mean, and that's a clear lie, right? Because cars, you're mostly stuck in traffic. So the promise of progress, of this sort of extractive-driven progress, is now, I think most people see that's a lie. And it's not working anymore. Mm-hmm. So for the first time, we are now experiencing a declining quality of life for younger generations. You know, age expectancy is going down, you know, and that's the kind of basic thing you want to give to your child, right? Well, things will be just maybe a little bit better, you know, and that's changing. So that is already happening. People can experience that. That doesn't mean we're now just descending into an inferno of hell. No, we're on a journey, and we're gonna go through a really tough time, and it's gonna be hard. And some people are gonna really experience a lot of hardship, some people more than others, particularly when you think globally. But we can totally come out of it into somewhere quite different, you know, into a different place. And I think there's a real appetite for that. So there is a kind of depressing figure about 70% of young people globally aren't just worried about climate. They feel hopeless about their future. You know, they feel abandoned by adults. I mean, how awful is that? What have we done that we've not given them the sense that we're in the fight for them, right? That's the generational responsibility. You're going to fight for your future. I know that sounds cheesy, but you know, you're going to do it. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy. So I totally agree. It's kind of it's this space between. It's not everything's going to be fine. We can be, you know, Pollyanna, and the future's going to be beautiful and rosy. or we're in despair and hell and, you know, it's all going, it's like apocalypse.
How we hold those contradictions.
Totally.
Right? And the contradictions that we find in, like, human nature, and the choices that we make about things.
Yes.
It's like, how can we just hold the messiness of that with a bit more compassion?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Sounds like there's a script in that.
I love the idea that, that art can enact change in people. And I was thinking about the post office scandal and how that was in the public consciousness and it was in the minds of politicians, but then a TV show happens. Mm-hmm. And almost instantaneously, actual change happens.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's because it sort of enters into the private space of people's homes or it connects in a safe space where people are open to... open to it or something, but it was amazing to me that it could instigate such dramatic change, an actual law change, and it happened so fast.
So fast.
And it was literally a TV show. And I wondered whether you felt that there could be an equivalent with climate change of a TV show, a fictionalised version of real events that could have that kind of impact that quickly.
100%. I mean, that's basically been my pitch for 3 years, is that that's what we need to do. Because, you know, how many documentaries have we had and how many blooming UN reports and how many front page news articles? And I don't want to knock the importance of that. That at that time, that's what we needed to communicate. We needed to tell people this is bad and it's serious. And all the scientists are telling you this is bad and it's serious. But we've done that. Comms job, that's done, that's way been done now. It's communicating itself now, climate change. So, and I think the reason why that was so powerful, it's same thing, you know, lots of tireless campaigners campaigning for that, documentaries and brilliant investigative journalism. And it's not that that wasn't effective, that kind of laid the groundwork, you know, but why it affected change, right? It's because it's this thing about what story does to you, particularly narrative story. It is, we don't realise it, but it's literally what our brains are hardwired to tune into. It's why we tell our kids stories, you know. And it's because it gets you right here, you know, it gets you in a different place than it does reading the figures and the facts. And it motivates you in a completely different way. Also, it's not just how I think it you respond as an audience, it's what it does socially, right? So what was really interesting with that, right, is that it already had an impact in the audience. You know, people were really outraged and really upset about it. But then, you know, the baton's picked up by that and it creates public conversation, and it creates a very different public conversation than if it had been a documentary. So 100%, that is what we're working on. Lots of Mr. Bates versus post office. Because it's also a justice story, basically. It's about normal people trying to get justice for an injustice, and that is what we need to see the climate crisis as. It's a major injustice. Like, we could have been in a very different place right now if 30 years ago, you know, the energy companies pivoted towards renewables, if politicians had a bit more bravery, you know, if banks invested differently, you know, we could be in a really different place. We're here, you know, it's an injustice, I think, and we need to feel that anger about the injustice, and those are the stories we need to tell. And there are so many stories of justice and people trying to create accountability, and those are the ones we need to tell, I think. Yeah.
Also, I think the thing about that programme was it was so human. It was this, and I think maybe that's what's missing from the climate change narrative, is I can think of so many big budget movies that are about that dystopian kind of thing, which you can't put yourself in, but when it's your village postman or something, or a dad, or a, you know, something human, then it applies to you and it connects to you in the heart.
So true. It's relatable. We can all relate to Greta. She's unusual, you know, she's an extraordinary person, but you can relate to the post office person. Yeah, totally. Yes.
Thanks, Lucy. It was really great. You said a really interesting fact about 70% of children have no hope, or similar. And myself as a mother, and yourself, are commissioners looking at working as educating our next generation? Is that kind of a piece of work that's being done?
We're doing a little bit, but I'm doing it very carefully and cautiously, because I feel quite strongly that I don't think we need to educate them about the facts of climate and that it's about something to be worried about. I think they're feeling the worry already. I think we need to teach children to love nature, because you fight for what you love, right? And we want them to love it and love what nature we have left, you know, and feel that that is their kin and that's their family as much as their real family. So I think there's a role for educating kids in that way, and maybe in preparing them, you know, for the future. And not, I mean, this is, as a mother, I find this a fine line. I've talked to lots of other mothers about this too. I don't want to keep it from them completely, but I do want them to keep their kind of childhood innocence, and I don't want to burden them with that. But I also think, look, we don't really have very much time on this issue. We really, it's up to us. It's not, it's kind of going to be too late for them, basically, when they're my age, to really avert the worst of it. They'll still have to do a lot to, you know, respond to the world that they're in. So I think it is important that we reflect it in how we're talking to children, but I think it has to be done so carefully and with all that nuance. So I don't have the perfect kind of example of what that would look like for kids' TV and film yet, but we are working on a couple of projects with that kind of gentle way. But I think talking in an age-appropriate way about it, the right way, but grounding it in love and, you know, all that good stuff, I think.
Humanity.
Key.
I love it.
But yeah, they'll tell you in when they're in therapy in the future if I got it wrong. I'm sure. There's no doubt, right?
Yeah, thank you, Lucy. That was really, really wonderful to hear the update on everything that's happening with Climate Spring. And my question is really about children and the next generation as well, because I think that, for me, the thing that feels very important as well as the loving nature is this story around resilience and knowing that they're going to be facing very difficult times ahead alongside us to begin with, and then maybe without us. And I wondered how much that's coming into the commissioning process, is this sense of pivoting and survival, and not survival as in I'm going to pack my, you know, pack to walk across the country and survive in the woods, but actually this ongoing survival, you know, there's lots of examples of communities that flood frequently at the moment, not just in this country, but in other countries, and how they continue to pick themselves up and continue to change and evolve, knowing that they're not going to solve the bigger problem, but they have to continue regardless. Yes. And I wondered how much that kind of story of resilience is coming into the programming.
I totally agree. I think it's a really good point. I think there was a great story. I don't know if you remember when. Do you remember a couple of years ago when Europe was experiencing really astronomical flooding, and when a lot of Germany was flooded, lots of towns, and certain in the UK as well. And it was, you know, it was really bad. Lots of people died. Lots of people lost their homes, and places were rendered uninhabitable for quite a long time. Some will never recover, and there's a brilliant team in Bangladesh who have done work on building resilience for decades, and they did some very funny communications around that, where they said, we'll send our best experts over to Europe to help you deal with the floods, because we've been doing this for a really long time. And it's, no joking aside, they have kind of in their culture, have obviously, it's a very low-lying country, you know, they've had to deal with flooding tsunamis, and live with the water, and actually they've built up a culture of resilience, both, you know, physical infrastructure of resilience, but also the culture of how to protect each other, how to, you know, look out for each other and make sure it's not a disaster and that no one dies. And so actually in Bangladesh in recent years, they've kind of, that most, they haven't had the catastrophic disasters that they used to historically have anyway. So I love that they were, you know, highlighting that culture of resilience. So I think, yes, I think it's really important. I don't have a great example of what that would look like yet, but we are thinking about that. And I think there's commissioners who've got that yet. I think I'd say that's the next stage, because I think there's nervousness, right? I think there's around some of the language about this. So I think, I think people can very easily think of climate solutions equals lots of technology. We need lots of renewables. We need lots of energy, which of course we do. Our houses need to be built differently, and the way we farm needs to be different. In fact, the way we do most things needs to be different. But there are values and cultural changes that we need to make. You know, we're not all going to survive if we all just go and live in bunkers. We're actually going to have to help each other out a bit. And that's a cultural shift as much as a tech shift, isn't it? And I think, that's part of responding to climate. Yeah, yeah.
That's a very interesting point, because quite a lot of the stories are about culpability and activism, which in a sense is a relatively negative tale compared with building resilience through community. Mm. And community is learning the importance of depending on others and having others depend upon you.
Mm.
And it's, you know, that's dependent upon being human and not just being right or clever. It's appreciating your relationship with other people and the relationship with nature. And that must provide a pretty good context for a fantastic metaphorical presentation. Because even if the people in Bangladesh, their stories are very positive and they're very indicative, aren't they, of how resilience and community build together. So that seems the direction we need to try and push ourselves, as opposed to, I mean, obviously activism and culpability is a good thing up to a point.
Yeah.
But it's a fairly negative approach and doesn't really focus on the future and why the future could be good.
Yeah. I mean, we got a little glimpse of this in the pandemic, right, in lockdown. We got a little glimpse of where's the real value in society? What are the really useful jobs? All the underpaid, caring jobs, you know, all the jobs that keep things going, you know, the farmers, you know, people delivering everything. We got also a sense of the value of being connected to each other and looking out for each other. And I don't know if anyone was in Tisbury in the pandemic, but there was Gustavo and my husband and a few others, that I couldn't believe how quickly they organised essentially a mutual aid kind of response. Within about 48 hours, there was a network of 100 people volunteering to help vulnerable people in Tisbury. So volunteering to, you know, go get their medicines and deliver them or pick up their veg or walk their dog. And that was like that, you know. And you think if we could always do that, when we're facing the real crisis, that don't want to say that the pandemic wasn't a real crisis. What I mean is an even bigger crisis of the climate crisis. Then our capacity for get throughing hardship is really extraordinary. And I think we've kind of culturally lost that a bit because we've been so culturally conditioned to be atomized into consumers and individuals. And we look after ourselves and our family and, you know, that's a cultural conditioning, and we've kind of forgotten. And that's actually also quite a relatively recent cultural conditioning. We've historically always been a networked people. Mm. That's how we're still here, really, basically, isn't it? Anyway. Yeah.
No, I love it. Mm-hmm. Any final questions?
Well, have you read Chris Nage's book, Small Farm Future?
I know about him and I know about the book. I haven't read it yet, but yeah, okay.
He's a bit of an activist.
No, I think he's good.
Annoying,
yeah.
But I mean, I think it's a very, you know, as an idea, it has a lot of promise.
Yeah, definitely.
And because it very much is premised on living with nature, living amongst communities, and people being very prepared to work together. Mm-hmm. And you know, as you were saying earlier, we only have a small contribution we can make, but the best thing we can do is try and build community through interdependencies where we are.
I think that's probably where we can have the biggest impact in a way, because there's a direct impact and then there's an indirect impact. But he's super interesting because, you know, there's so many binaries in the climate debate, aren't there? There's a binary that you have to be vegan or your carbon polluting farmer, you know, meat eater. And you know, you can see farmers are getting pitted against environmentalists at the moment. We're on the same side. Yeah, exactly. You know, farms are going through a huge transition at the moment, and they're being abandoned. They're not being supported. Mm. You know, the business model of farming is not working because they've been incentivized to produce food in the most environmentally destructive way, and it's not even working economically. They're making a loss, and it's not working for their own health and well-being, and it's just a failing business model. Mm. And most farmers would like to see themselves as a custodian of the land. They don't want to see themselves as contributing to the problem, but then it doesn't help when they're pitted against environmentalists, and there's deliberate sabotage going on. You know, there is. Has anyone heard of astroturfing as a strategy? Has anyone heard of this? It's a really nefarious opposition strategy that the fossil fuel industry and the plastics industry deploy all the time, which is basically fake campaigning. So they'll pay actors to go and, you know, into a public debate. They'll pay actors to sit in a public debate and pretend to be members of good, upstanding citizens of Tisbury who will say, I do not support, you know, this project. And they will, you know, rabble rouse. You do it on social media all the time, you know, fake influencers or paid influencers paid to promote certain speaking points. And it's really hard, right? Because then most people see that as, they don't know that that's not real. And they think, well, there's genuine kind of grassroots outrage. And then politicians use that as an excuse for, well, there's real outrage here. You know, we're not going to wade into that. So, and it's all made up, really. We're all on the same page here, which is we're all trying to navigate towards a better way of doing things. And we need to be with the farmers spraying their manure over the government buildings. I don't know if anyone saw that. Brilliant. I love that. I was like, that is a good campaign strategy. Spray your manure over the... That's the French farmers. I don't think you'd see that in the UK, sadly. But yeah, we should be with them. And, you know, all these industries are going through transition crises because it's not being managed. No one is managing this transition. So we should be in solidarity with them and be with them and support them in every way. And then it's not us against them. It's, you know, it's all of us. We're in it together, basically. Yeah.
I think that so much of that is also about rethinking the idea of and concept of ownership, land ownership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that those a lot of those farmers are bound by, and landowners too, this idea of legacy.
Yeah.
And so there's a really big cultural piece, I think. You know, like, I write articles about farmers. I'm really interested in that space. I'm interested in farmers who are innovating with long-term in mind, and landowners too.
Mm.
And I feel like the way that land is divided in this country, and it's so hard for people to then access land and then make
possibly
difference themselves in their own communities.
Yes.
So how can we bring all those, you know, the communities, the farmers, the landowners together to like take this idea of us and them away and like how can we help each other?
Well, it's this imagination capture that we've got. You know, we can't, particularly in the UK, I think we're the origin of this very extractive industrialized way of doing things, and in a way that has captured all of our imaginations. We can't imagine that there's another way of doing things except big industry, big agriculture, you know, big industrialized processes. It's all quite relatively recent, you know, in the history of the world, in the history of humanity. And, you know, in fact, in France, most farmers still in France are small-scale farmers, okay, compared to the UK, you know. And it's the same with renewables. So in Germany, I think about 10 years ago now, it's not the case sadly anymore, but about 10 years ago, most of the renewable energy in Germany that was being developed, and I don't mean little Tisbury-scale projects, some solar panels on school roofs, big-scale commercial projects, were being developed by co-ops. But we can't kind of imagine that here. We think that's like far out, that there are big cooperatives taking on and competing with big commercial brands. That's what I mean by imagination capture. We can't believe it, but it's totally possible. And I think, you know, the way you can kind of crack through that is to make it happen. get involved, do it, and find well, that was great timing, thanks. got my back, thanks. Anyway, I should stop rabbiting on, shouldn't
no,
I?
No, not at all, not at all, love it. I'm conscious of time and thirst. Would love two final questions. One, where would you suggest people direct people for further reading, hopeful inspiration, you know, places of, just to follow up on some of these key topics?
Well, for storytelling, for climate, for what we're doing, we you know, on our website, and you can sign up to our newsletter, we're regularly doing, creating offers. So we're about to launch another competition for writers. We just did a short animation competition, which we're just shortlisting. We're creating opportunities all the time, and we tend to work with quite established industry, experienced industry writers and producers, but we are always creating opportunities for newer writers. In terms of climate more broadly, do you mean, or just climate storytelling?
Climate more broadly.
So one of the programs we've developed at Climate Spring, which is quite fun, is our world building program. Because as you will all no doubt have kind of experienced, if somebody says to you, okay, all right, you get what we're fighting for, right? We're trying to, you know, stop a fossil fuel destructive, you know, descent into dystopia. What are we fighting for? What does it look like? What would Tisbury look like if we reduced our impact, if we were regenerative, if we lived, you know, within our ecological means?
If the Nadda properly flooded.
If the Nadda flooded.
Like,
well, interestingly, the, you know, the floodplain by the station?
Yeah.
I think in the new Tisbury plan, that's going to be, it's going to return to a floodplain, which is, you know, a good thing. So what would it look like? I think that is what we need to visualise, because we need to understand, do we have to give something up? That's, most people think we have to give something up. We're going to have to sacrifice and live in a cave, you know. We might have to give some things up. We will. We can't fly around all the time on, you know, short breaks. We are going to have to change some things, but we're also going to gain an awful lot. We're going to benefit an awful lot. And that is a kind of world-building fun I think we need to have with that. And there are... So we've created a bit of a world-building map of all the projects that we can find that are real projects that exist right now, from little villages to cities. You know, Amsterdam is becoming the first city to try and live within its ecological means. So we're trying to map some of that, so you can go get some inspiration and find out about it. But we've got that.
Very conveniently links to our next event, people, run by the equally talented Gus Stavo, Lucy's husband. We are running... And this wasn't prompted, actually, but very conveniently.
That was a beautiful segue.
Thank you for that. A world-building workshop for writers here, April the 25th. Please sign up. We haven't actually put it live yet because we've only confirmed it today. No, that's great to hear. And final question.
Yes.
What's the best way of people getting in contact with you? I mean, these guys are going to talk to you afterwards, but anybody who's listening to this on the podcast?
You know, all the old-fashioned ways through our website.
Send a letter?
You can send it by pigeon. Yeah, that could work. You can contact us by email, and we're on social, you know, we're on Twitter, and we have a newsletter you can sign up to where we give information about the opportunities coming up, things like that.
Love it.
So yeah, all those ways.
Cool. Lucy, thank you so much. It's been fascinating, and I wish you every success.
Thanks, Will.
There it goes. Thank you.